District of Conservation is sponsored by the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow, CFACT. To learn more about our sponsor, head over to CFACT.org. Thank you so much for listening to the program. Welcome to District of Conservation. I am your host, Gabriella Hoffman. This podcast offers a sober examination into all things hunting, fishing, shooting sports, energy, environment, and the public policy surrounding it. And this podcast also specializes in original interviews that you won't hear elsewhere. Here's what I have for you today. I've got a special Tuesday roundup for you all. A lot of breaking news has been unfurling for the past few days, like literally the last 1 to 2 days. There have been some interesting headlines. There's a topic I've been meaning to discuss here in podcast format, but I've weighed in on social media. What I'm largely going to be focusing on today, we're going to briefly talk about, I need to talk about this, the Florida Sun Sentinel, a South Florida publication going after Florida's hunters and anglers for wanting to enact a right to hunt and fish amendment in their state constitution. We've talked about this issue at length here on the program. I also want to talk about two potential cases to the Supreme Court that may clarify and limit presidential powers, particularly Section 2 of the Antiquities Act, because reform has been long overdue. So that's an exciting development. And I also want to talk about the reintroduction of wolves in Colorado. We've had Mia Anstein and several others come talk about this issue. Just yesterday, a video clip that's been going viral on social media has been circulated from the Colorado Parks and Wildlife, showing that they have followed the wishes of Colorado voters via ballot box biology, and they have released 5 wolves into, I believe it was Grand County. I think that's where I visited when I went to Colorado about a year ago. So let's break down these 3 interesting updates for you today here on the program. The South Florida Sun Sentinel has an op-ed, or rather an editorial out in the last few days that is bemoaning hunters and anglers who, in the state of Florida, the Sunshine State, who care deeply about wanting to protect their hunting and fishing heritage. Because if you listen to the show frequently or semi-frequently or even occasionally drop in to listen to District of Conservation, you know that there are pressing threats. Some of them are overt. Some of them are not as overt. They're more subtle. That are being waged on hunting and fishing, our sporting heritage here in the United States. It comes largely from the left. Sometimes we see it from the political right with the Return Act. But we cover any and all threats to hunting and fishing that percolate. And the rise, or rather the interest in right to hunt and fish amendments, is something that is legitimate. It is not, what I'm about to tell you, a low information or far right position to take. It's a bipartisan position that 23 states, including a handful of blue states, Vermont being one of them, have taken. Actually, Vermont, if you didn't know this, was the first state to enact a right to hunt and fish amendment, or a semblance of that, in 1777, the oldest in the books. The state most recently that adopted it was Utah in 2020. And there have been efforts in Montana to strengthen theirs. There's been efforts that have failed in Arizona. And it's been difficult to pass it, even in red states like Missouri, Ohio, Florida, and a handful of others. And there are some that don't exist in red states that should be having them. You would naturally think that'd be the case, but it's not. So 23 states across the U.S., including Virginia, including Texas, I think Rhode Island may have the right to hunt, right to fish, not hunt. And then California may have the right to fish, but not to hunt there. And you won't see that pass in California anytime soon, I'm afraid, given the electorate there in my home state. But anyway, let's talk more about Florida. So this editorial board is accusing hunters and anglers in Florida of being low information, far right voters. So they have questions about the ballot initiative. Why the urgency? Why do they need this? They say that, so what's the point of putting this on the ballot? The best argument we can see for this stinker is that it's bait, intended to draw out low information, far right voters who can be easily swindled into believing that their rights are somehow under attack and who will presumably be voting conservative across the rest of the ballot. And Florida's deep red legislature doesn't care about anything else if it means winning a few more votes. That's a really cheap shot. And I'm actually really offended as a journalist and someone who likes to pride myself in accuracy. And I'm offended. I cover this issue very frequently. And they had the gall to be extremely lazy in their research. Oh, it gets better. Let me read you this section of the op-ed. They claim that right to hunt and fish amendments wreck environmental laws, and that there's little support for them So they want lawmakers to hear from their constituents who are suspicious of this amendment and other reckless efforts to hoodwink voters with one clear message that this dog don't hunt. I reminded town hall readers, and it's pretty available out there, that this particular resolution in Florida, even though Florida is, yes, predominantly Republican, it's a Republican majority legislature from the House of Representatives to the state Senate, everyone except for one Democrat in the state Senate, 116 in the House of Representatives to zero, and 38-1 in the state Senate, including Democrats, even though they're in the minority, they overwhelmingly, both parties, supported this resolution. It didn't require the governor's signature, so it now goes on to the ballot next year in November 2024. So tell me, what is a minority position of this, or what is so extreme about this when you had everyone, except for one person, support this resolution in the legislature this year? So it's not low IQ, it's not far right, it's a reasonable position. Again, 23 states have this constitutional right to hunt and fish because states want to preemptively protect their constitutions from future reimagining or future prohibitions on different kinds of hunting and fishing types and modes and seasons. We see this happening in states like Washington, Colorado, which we'll talk about a little later. Different efforts within state wildlife agencies or external pressure onto state wildlife agencies to change what their mission statement should be, to divorce hunters and anglers from conservation. So it's only natural that states like Florida want this. I don't blame them. We have this here in Virginia. This doesn't invite any more poaching. It doesn't invite any dissolution of environmental quality. It doesn't trample on property rights. This doesn't excuse poor sportsmanship or unethical hunting or fishing behavior. Those are still forbidden. You can't be poaching. You can't be committing criminal acts even with right to hunt and fish amendments. If anything, protection of environment is enhanced in states that are very friendly to hunting and fishing. More Pittman, Robertson, and Dingell Johnson dollars go to states with right to hunt and fish amendments. I haven't been able to establish a direct correlation, but Texas has one. Texas has the most hunters in all of the United States. States that have these protections seem to have, anecdotally speaking, more people who hunt and fish, therefore more Pittman, Robertson, Dingell Johnson funds that go to not only bolster wildlife numbers, but also restore habitats, stock fish, do so many things to improve the environment. So I am extremely offended. I know I'm very fired up about this and I sound a little angry and a little, you know, miffed, but this is complete misunderstanding and botching of what a right to hunt and fish amendments are. And this is a bipartisan measure. This is not some far-right, low-information position. I have to reiterate that again. And personally speaking, like, to see that my friends are being tarnished indirectly, I have several friends who've been behind this ballot measure. Travis Thompson, Mike Elfenbein, so many Florida conservationists who you guys have gotten to know here on this program. They're not some low-information, far-right people. Yeah, they may lean more right politically. Great. That doesn't matter. They work with people across all partisan lines too to promote true conservation in the Sunshine State. But to see that the board is going after folks like that, hardworking folks who care about water quality, who care about environmental stewardship, who care about hunting and fishing and preserving those pastimes, especially as Florida continues to grow and you see fewer wild spaces now with these accommodations having to be made to accommodate a growing population. And they're concerned about how do you strike a balance there with a growing population and maintaining wild spaces. That's who really should have been profiled in the Sun Sentinel. But no, they derided everyone, including Travis, Mike, and the countless others that I've gotten to meet in Florida as low information and far right people. I think my friends are going to challenge this. I've heard little inklings that there may be some responses coming in written form. Let's hope so. If these newspapers respect the free speech rights in First Amendment, I hope they do allow for a rebuttal to this really atrocious op-ed. Learn more at Town Hall. I have a whole op-ed on this. I made a reel on my Instagram as well. So I try to debunk the misinformation that this editorial put out there. The Antiquities Act, if you all know and listen to the show very closely, is one of my favorite topics to discuss. I like the law, but I think it is compromised by lack of clarity and not having some modernization to it. And something that interested me and excited me is the potential of two court cases, if they are to be heard before the Supreme Court, that could bring some much needed clarity and perhaps limit presidential powers under the Antiquities Act. So a president, let's say President Biden, who's been doing this very frequently, can't carte blanche designate millions of acres under small area compatible stipulations under Section 2 of the law. Is a million acres a small area compatible? Does it protect antiquities? Those are the questions people should be asking. These lawmakers from the Western Caucus are asking these questions because they see the president is abusing this to basically keep and make multiple use public lands off limits to multiple uses, not only from a grazing or energy development perspective, but even those trickle down, those prohibitions will eventually trickle down to recreation. We've documented that here on the program. I've written about this. It doesn't just stop at so-called consumptive uses. It also affects recreation. What are the two court cases that the Western Caucus and some groups are wanting to petition to SCOTUS? So the first case is called the American Forest Resource Council versus United States of America. And the second case is Murphy Company versus Biden. So let's talk about this first case from the American Forest Resource Council, and announced today, December 19th, that 29 members of U.S. Congress, along with this council and six other organizations, have filed amicus curiae briefs in support of the group and the Association of ONC Counties joint petition for a writ of certiorari with the Supreme Court. They are asking for the court to review an Obama-era expansion of the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument and the Bureau of Land Management's 2016 Resource Management Plan for Western Oregon ONC lands. And this press release says the case poses legal questions of national interest around executive branch overreach and the use of the Antiquities Act to nullify congressional intent of federal lands. Quote, momentum is building for the U.S. Supreme Court to answer a fundamental question. Who makes the laws regarding federal land management, Congress or the executive branch, says President Travis Joseph. The illegal expansion of this national monument on ONC lands and the 2016 RMP's executive decision that directly undermines Congress action on the same lands set a dangerous precedent for every federal land management law that Congress has approved. We are building support nationally because many Americans and their elected officials are concerned about the implications of presidents having unfettered authority to indefinitely suspend or cancel the operation of federal laws through the Antiquities Act proclamations and other executive actions. And they thank Congressman Cliff Bentz of Oregon for his leadership on the amicus brief and for bringing awareness to these important issues on Capitol Hill, end quote. And I will read a little more from the Western Caucus about their brief. And the second one, Murphy Company versus Biden as well. So here's what Congressman Cliff Bentz, who was leading the efforts here, says. So the Constitution makes clear that Congress, not the president, makes our laws. The president's job is not to make law, but to enforce them. Yet in recent years, presidents have increasingly usurped congressional authority by using the Antiquities Act to monumentize millions upon millions of acres of public land, rendering massive areas largely untouchable. This blatant disregard for the will of the people is an affront to the Constitution, he said. In this brief, we urge the Supreme Court to hear these cases and to make clear that the president cannot circumvent Congress by rewriting our nation's public land laws with the stroke of a pen. This is about upholding the Constitution, protecting our public lands from being left to burn up, and that they can be properly managed with the best interest in mind. And this has support from Natural Resources Chair Bruce Westerman, Western Caucus Chair Dan Newhouse of Washington, and many others. There are three key takeaways from the Western Caucus amicus brief. They are concerned about presidential overreach, economic devastation, and constitutional violation. And I have included in the show notes for you there. And I have talked about this before, that the Supreme Court, I think, said in 2021 that at some point, because of this volleying back and forth between whether or not a president can enlarge, create, shrink, diminish a national monument, it has gone back and forth. Different presidents, Democratic administrations have largely done this carte blanche without really considering Section 2 of the Antiquities Act, meaning smallest compatible area. What does that mean? Does it include antiquities or does it include things that are not antiquities? That hasn't been fully adhered to, of course, in this case. President Trump received a lot of controversy and he was labeled someone who had stolen American lands. That's what Patagonia and some other outfitters had deemed, even though not 1 acre of public land was sold to anyone in this case. So they totally botched that. And I was defending the president, the former president, when that came out in 2017 with that billboard and that kind of ad that was brought out in some of the most prominent newspapers. And if you need to learn more about the Antiquities Act, what does it mean? What are the limitations? Where Congress should step in? How can Congress reform the Antiquities Act? I have a great explainer in a form of a unicorn fact check at Independent Women's Forum. I'm going to link to it because I can talk about this on and on and on. You've heard me talk about the subject, but there does need to be more congressional oversight. It has to be clarified what a small area compatible or smallest area compatible in Section 2 of the law means. Do you need approval from the counties and the states affected? That's been some touted reform that has been communicated through previous bills to reform and clarify and modernize the Antiquities Act. And is it a truly democratic law? The process, especially for the Antiquities Act, as we've seen in recent actions, that is not the case. We see that these environmental groups directly petition the president, and then groups that may not be in support of these monument listings under the Antiquities Act, because they are being used in this case to lock up land, to close off land to multiple uses, and then including also recreational. Again, you should be extremely worried about the incremental kind of prohibitions that would come with this. It doesn't just stop at things and activities you may not like. You may not like oil and gas development. You may not like grazing. You may not like ranching. But these restrictions don't stop there. They eventually trickle down to hunting and fishing. If you're able to get protections for hunting and fishing, that's great. And I don't have a problem with that necessarily. But we don't see that respected in a lot of these Western states, and they should be. And so, like I said, there have to be reforms. You have to have oversight. It has to be democratic, and you have to have every stakeholder truly heard. But we see a sidestepping of stakeholders here. So I welcome this. I will link to the amicus brief. I will link to my unicorn fact check here and let you guys explore this topic in more detail. But this is something that gets me really excited. I love this topic because it beckons and requires a lot of nuance. You need to have nuance. And presidential authority actually is, you know, up for grabs here. And Congress can clarify that. And like I said, even the Supreme Court has said, we may have to weigh in on this matter if Congress can't get its act together and clarify the law, bring it into modernity, and actually have some oversight over it. Because there's actually two states where presidential authority does not apply. It's Alaska and Wyoming. So Alaska and Wyoming were very smart to ensure that the Antiquities Act is not abused in their respective states. So I imagine other states are going to beckon for similar exemptions or for similar oversight that these two states have currently on the books. But we see a sidestepping of this administration ignoring these provisions in Alaska and Wyoming for certain designations. And like I said, national monuments do have a place. They have to be open for multiple uses. I don't like to see this law being abused, and I don't like seeing public recreation is kicked off or being restricted when these occur. And this may be controversial to some of my listeners and to people I work with, but I don't think every national monument should be teed up to become a national park. It has to be an extremely extraordinary parcel of land, something that is worth protecting, that should be off limits to development. And there is a place for that. But if the president is using that for so many case uses, which I feel like he is, just to stop mining, stop energy development, stop grazing, and sometimes stop hunting and fishing, and even off-roading and ATVing and OTVing, just to create more public lands that are very similar to national parks, when they don't have that extraordinary case to be a national park, or when the lands he's locking up are not antiquities. You need to actually be protecting antiquities. I saw that in Bears Ears. I like the smaller kind of plan of Bears Ears because it actually protects antiquities. Are these five areas that the president has deemed, you know, deserving of having Antiquities Act protections to become national monuments? There are five areas he has proposed since coming to office. And he's also enlarged and restored Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. So he's done a lot of stuff here. It's at least a couple million acres here that he's either expanded or enlarged or established from the get-go. And you're going to be seeing a lot of lawsuits. And until Congress weighs in, you're going to see this contentious battle play out on this issue. And we need Congress to clarify once and for all what a small area compatible is. There needs to be more oversight. So that's what we're going to hone in on here. Resources in show notes for your liking. Do a deep dive. I'm also going to include the Brookings Institution, which is no friend to conservatives, saying that presidents actually have the authority to shrink monuments too. We will keep tabs to see if this goes anywhere. I don't know if they're going to be hearing this Supreme Court session because they're underway hearing new cases. Likely the next Supreme Court term where this could be heard if either of these two cases are brought before SCOTUS. But we will keep track of this here at District of Conservation. And finally, we are going to round out today's discussion by drawing your attention to Colorado. We're going to take our efforts to Colorado and the news over them introducing 5 wolves that were trapped from Eastern Oregon and transplanted to Grand County, Colorado. I believe this is near Granby, or this is where Granby is. Yes, Granby does fall in Grand County. So this is a little below the national park and kind of in these, you know, ski towns and vacation spots. Interesting county to relocate them to, away from Denver and the population centers that largely voted in favor of forced wolf reintroduction. That's where these wolves should actually be aimed, if we're being honest here. But more seriously, a tweet from Colorado Parks and Wildlife dated yesterday, December 18th, a historic day for Colorado, and for the first time ever, we released 5 wolves, 3 males and 2 females, in Grand County yesterday. Captured in Oregon, the wolves were evaluated by our veterinarians and biologists fitted with GPS collars and transported to Colorado for their release. Today's release fulfills the wish of Colorado voters who in 2020 directed us to begin reintroducing wolves by December 1st, 2023, and kickstops our goal to release 10 to 15 wolves by mid-March 2024. I will include that link they link to here for you all to read about their plan if you're just curious. Someone asks them, interestingly enough, when can we start hunting them legally? And the account responds, our current wolf management plan does not consider wolf hunting, but was discussed by the 2 wolf working groups that should future wolf populations reach certain levels, a future Parks and Wildlife Commission with proper legal authority may seek to reclassify them as a game species. I don't know about you, but if you have a basic understanding of wildlife conservation, you know, and it's going to be uncomfortable for a lot of these ballot box biology voters to grasp this, there has to be a discussion about management. It initially will come this discussion about take, perhaps in the case of predation by wolves when it comes to someone's livestock. That's going to be more immediately part of the discussion. Like, is there an ability to recoup for lost livestock if these wolves, if their numbers start to grow and they start to become a stable population? Will farmers be compensated? Ranchers be compensated for anything lost? What about pet owners? And then I think down the road, there will be a discussion about, okay, the wolf has met carrying capacity in this particular region. Can we have a hunt? As the tweet mentioned, that wasn't part of the immediate discussion, but if it were to be restored to a healthy number and possibly be classified as a game species down the road, is that conversation going to be had? But like we've seen in areas, the Great Yellowstone ecosystem, the Great Lakes region, we have seen this battle with wolves that have met the threshold of recovery that should be delisted and management brought back to the state subsequently. But we've seen this administration play politics here. This is much like grizzly bears. This is very similar to the debate over Antiquities Act. You know, what oversight should states have versus the federal government when a species has met the threshold of recovery? But this is a slightly different case because you have a state now engaging in ballot box biology, voters narrowly voting to reintroduce wolves, but not considering the consequences of their actions here. If you want to learn more about this subject, because I could go long-winded here and there's a lot of details to discuss, you know, about the federal reintroduction of wolves and protections under the Endangered Species Act, but I want to point you to my conversation with Mia Anstein, who is probably the most foremost Colorado conservationist out there. She gets this issue. She has a lot of concerns about this effort and expressed her hesitance about celebrating this in totality because she doesn't think the wildlife managers have really thought this out thoroughly. And that's a natural concern to have. So before you get excited about wolf reintroduction, I want you to hear Mia's thoughts on this subject. Listen to her, listen to our conversation we've had here on the show, read some of the articles from people who are a little skeptical of this plan going forward. And before you accuse me of being anti-wolf, she wants these wolves to be hunted to extirpation, I don't. I think wolves are brilliant, and I think wolves are necessary to the ecosystem and our landscapes. As charismatic megafauna and apex predators, they have a place on the landscape. Nobody disputes that. I'm not anti-wolf. But as I mentioned on Twitter, while they have a place on the landscape, reintroduction efforts have to consider that there will have to be some conversations, hard conversations about the responsibilities that come with this, and a conversation about management, something that a lot of voters unfortunately overlooked when engaging in ballot box biology. This is not, you know, ignorance, overt ignorance perhaps, but a lot of bad intel that was fed to these voters by preservationist groups who were heralding this ballot initiative. And so, like I said, I am pro-wolf, but I'm pro-management of wolves too, because that is what has to happen with wildlife. That's a necessary tool. It's a necessary conversation that has to be had, a discussion that has to be had. And I trust the people on the ground more than I trust out-of-state interests coming into Colorado and dictating, you need to have forced reintroduction of wolves. And these are wolves, again, not from Colorado. They're from Eastern Oregon. And there's actually been, as Mia has talked about here on the podcast several times, wolves have been coming down from Wyoming to Colorado. So there was already a natural population of wolves before this segment from Eastern Oregon came in and was reintroduced just yesterday, or first released back into the wild from Western Oregon yesterday. So there have already been known sightings and instances of wolves occurring in Colorado, coming from Wyoming and other nearby states. So does that defeat, or does that mean that this is a wasted effort? It remains to be seen. We're going to be watching this because I would love to be proven wrong here. I honestly would love to be proven wrong. But as a skeptic and someone who likes to follow wildlife science and trust the biologists here, I don't know what to think of this. And I don't want voters who may not be informed on wildlife management decisions to be making choices here, especially those who don't support hunting as a management tool. It's just a natural fear I have, a natural concern I have. And so read up more on this issue. I encourage you to do so. Listen to voices like Mia Anstein and others on the ground who would be impacted by this. Like I said, Grand County may be far away from Denver. It may be far away from Southern Colorado in areas where this will be impacted. But like I said, wolves reproduce very quickly. They're going to bounce back pretty quickly with having no natural predators to deal with. And so what are Colorado parks and wildlife managers going to do when they cause conflicts with people? They eat pets. Or if elk numbers, like I said, Colorado home to the largest, I think, segment of naturally occurring in recent years, of course, elk populations, the Rocky Mountain elk segment, what is that going to do to their numbers? Because it will have an impact. Let's be honest with ourselves. It does have an impact. It had an impact in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. Wolf numbers increase, elk numbers have gone down. Could happen here too. These are great questions to ask. It doesn't make you a reactionary or someone who's far right or low information or wanting to decimate wolves just to ask these questions. It's only natural to ask questions of forced wolf reintroduction efforts here via ballot box biology. We ask those questions here on the program. I hope you start to ask those questions too, even if you're not in Colorado. We all have to care about this because this could be replicated in other states. Mark my words, we are seeing this. This makes people and organizations like Wildlife for All, who want to divorce hunters and anglers from critical wildlife management decisions, this makes them giddy. Oh, we have a win in Colorado. Let's try this somewhere else. We see this happening, these incremental attacks on hunting, on wildlife conservation, on following the science here. So it's okay to ask questions. I like to ask questions. It doesn't make me any less legitimate, or it shouldn't put my credentials into question if I ask these questions. You should be asking questions of people who are using tools like ballot box biology to make sometimes not well-informed conservation decisions. And could this have a ricochet effect? Could this be tried in other states? That makes me extremely worried. I want to follow the science here, the wildlife science. It may not be followed here necessarily if our worst predictions are to come true about wolf reintroduction efforts. It's okay to ask these questions. Thanks for listening to District of Conservation. If you enjoyed what you heard today, go leave us some reviews on Apple and Spotify or wherever podcasts are played. Your feedback will help us reach more people, and I love to know what is on your mind after each episode. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter to never miss a beat or a guest announcement, because that is our way of updating all of you listeners, and we have just hit 1,000 followers on Instagram for the podcast account. Thank you very much. And if you have any guest suggestions or topics you want to hear on the show, I'm all ears. I would love to hear your feedback there. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for the next episode.